Okay, today is April 28th, and it is Yud. No. it doesn't show up on there. Bye.
24th day of the Omer.
24th day of the Omer. the 9th of ER. Okay. 5775. Okay, so, I wanted... Hi, Shoshi, how are you?
Yep, thank you.
Okay, so we had just completed last week a comparison of the stories in Perek Tet, where we're introduced to Sha'ul, with the psukim in Devarim describing the laws of a melech. And we saw how each of these little stories that seemed like a lot of details sort of illustrate how Sha'ul would be able to carry out all of these halachot of the melech, not caring so much about money. We see that with the donkey and with how he doesn't have money on him, the not too many wives. We see how he's not distracted by all the women at the well trying to talk to him. We're going to discuss that some more further. And et cetera, et cetera, all those things. So I found Rav Amnon Bazak has a whole series of shirim on Shmuel Aleph on the VBM website. So I had sort of hinted that maybe some of his actions would also speak to why he failed ultimately as a king in the end. So Rav Amnon Bazak described it really succinctly on his website. So that's in your supplement sheet. So he said, in describing the way he says, let's go home, my father's going to be worried more about me than the donkeys, and his lad, his Na'ar, then says, I hear there's a man of God here. So he says, this description presents Sha'ul as one who cannot stick to his goal. So rather than seeing it as concern for his father, Rav Bazak is seeing it as giving up before he's accomplished his goal, even though, as we saw, he went all over the country, near and far and everywhere.
Why is it the sign that he's giving up on his...
Because he's not accomplishing the goal he set out to do in finding the donkeys. And then he's willing to just go home.
Oh.
No, like, he hasn't met Shmuel yet. Okay? And is supporting himself to the dominant personality of the lad. So on the one hand, we see that he doesn't feel superior to anybody, which is really good. But on the other hand, Rav Bazak is hinting here that the fact that he's taking orders, so to speak, from the Na'ar is maybe not so good. So alongside the modesty that characterizes Sha'ul in this account, his hesitancy and attempt to avoid fulfilling the mission that had been cast upon him and upon his lad are evident. It is precisely his lad who demonstrates persistence and creativity and refuses to reconcile himself with Sha'ul's readiness to return home empty-handed. So the Na'ar is the one who suggests they see this, the man of God, the seer. It is precisely this quality of Sha'ul that will cause him to stumble as he tries to fulfill the function that had been cast upon him. Sha'ul will fail on a number of occasions, and in all of them, the qualities of hesitancy, failure to stick to a mission, and lack of confidence may be seen as essential components that explain those failures. Thus, for example, he will bow to the pressure of the people and offer sacrifices without waiting for Shmuel, chapter 13, where Shmuel told him expressly to wait, and he will not control the people with respect to eating meat and the blood, chapter 14, or with respect to taking spoils from Amalek, chapter 15. That's just to mention now that in the Megillah, where it repeats a few times that when the Jews fought back, they did not take any spoils. It's a tikkun for here, as we spoke about before, the similarities between Sha'ul and Mordechai, both from Binyamin. This being the case, already in our first meeting with Sha'ul, we see the complexity of his personality. The quality of modesty is an essential condition for the success of the idea of the monarchy, but it must be found in a person who can lead, who, despite his skills, recognizes the smallness of man in relationship to Hashem and conducts himself with the appropriate humility. Modesty that stems from a lack of self-confidence and indecisiveness is not a quality befitting a king. At this stage, the nature of Sha'ul's modesty is still not entirely clear. The full picture will become clear little by little. Okay, so then I just wanted to touch on one other thing that I mentioned last week, and I finally remembered. I was thinking of Graceland, where Elvis lives. Remember how we said, like, here he is? So the place that they finally get to is a place called Tsuf, which I then associated with Haramatayim Tsufim, the original place that we said that Shmuel was from, saying it was his land. So I was re-listening, I was listening to a shir, and he was, the rabbi who was giving the shir, was saying that this was a random place that we don't know where it is, and it what and Shmuel just happened to be there. So then I was kind of embarrassed. Like, I made this whole big deal of saying this is his homeland, and they weren't aware, and, you know, who's Shmuel? And there's this guy here who lives here who I think God speaks to. But then, of course, I found in the Ralbag, which made me very excited, justification, legitimization for my own answer. So he says, Hema be'eretz Tsuf, so on the supplementary sheet again. So this is in the land of Tsuf. Ki harama shehaya beit Shmuel sham. This is the hill where the house of Shmuel was there. Vikara eretz Tsuf, and was called the land of Tsuf. Lufi shehayu ayoshvim sham mityachasim betsuf. Kumo berosh zehasefer ki alkana haya ben Tsuf. So it's called the land of Tsuf because the settlers there were related in some way to Tsuf, as it says at the very beginning of this book, that Elkanah was a son of Tsuf. V'lo nichnasu adayin berama, but they hadn't entered into the hill. Achayu besadeh ha'ir, but they were still in the field of the city. Okay? So they've just entered into the territory of all these people who were related to Tsuf somehow. Okay, so that made me very excited because I was a little embarrassed at first, but now, then I was excited by the Ralbag. Okay, so then we're going to save the last pasuk here for the last section, and we're back to our packet. So, okay. So, let's read the Alshich first, and then we're going to come back and do this Gemara, and then we'll go on to the last part of the supplementary sheet. Okay, so the Alshich just offers some really enlightening insights into these psukim that we read last week, introducing us to Shaul. The Alshich was a Kabbalist living in 16th century Tzfat. Rav Chaim Vital was his student, and his teacher was Rav Yosef Kaira. And he's one of the few people who gets to be called the Alshich HaKadosh, who gets to be called HaKadosh. Okay? So beginning with the first couple of psukim, actually he refers to more than he actually quotes here. So it says, I'll just read it, Vayhi Ish mi Binyamin. There was a man from Binyamin, Ushmo Kish, Ben Aviel, Ben Tzur, Ben Bechorat, Ben Afiach, Ben Ish, Yemini, Gibur Chal. V'lo haya Ben Ushmo Shaul, and he had a son, his name was Shaul, Bachur V'tov, who was a Bachur, a young man, and good. V'ein Ish mi Bnei Yisrael Tov Mimenu. And there was no man better than him, Mishichmo Amala Gavoa Mikol Am, and he was head and shoulders above the nation. So, just what Alshich is going to mention, this contrast between calling him a bachor, which means a young man, and then also, a few words later, referring to him as a ish. So he was bachor v'tov, ve'ein ish mi b'nei Yisrael. Okay, so sort of this contrast between, is he a young man, is he a ish? So the Alshich is going to speak to that. Okay, so it's on page, everyone know where we are?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so V'lo haya ben ushmo Shaul bachor v'tov. So he had a son, his name was Shaul, a young man and good. Hine derech habachrut lehamshich et ha'adam achar hara. So it's usually the way of bachrut, meaning adolescence, I guess. Maybe the stage after adolescence.
Yeah,
teenagehood, right? Youth?
Yeah, like a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
Out of high school.
Okay. So it's usually the way of this stage in your life for a man to go after the bad, right? To rebel. Amar ki lo ken haya Shaul. But the pasuk is telling us that this was not the way of Shaul. Ki im bachor v'tov. So the Alshich here is noticing, why doesn't it say bachor tov? Why does it say bachor v'tov? Because that's actually unusual, to be a bachor and also good. Okay? Ki mehayaldut bachor bachar v'tov. Because from his childhood, and again, the Alshich is doing a play on words with the verb to choose. So, which is Livchor, and here is Bachor, youth, and Bachor Livchor to choose. From his youth, he chose good. V'lo haya Bachor v'tov be'erach Bachorim zelato. And there was no other youth in this way that besides him that was as good as he was. Kim gam tov mishar averot me'abachrut likare ish. Because he was so good from those sins that usually occur in youth, that he was able to be called an ish, a man. Lo haya ish mi b'nei Yisrael tov mimenu. And there was not even a man in b'nei Yisrael that was better than he was. V'gam l'shiyar uvu anashim v'yachshavuhu ka'asher ya'ut l'melech. And also when people would see him, they would think that he was beautiful like a king. Shetehe emato al ha'am, that fear of him would be on the nation. Haya mishichmo amala gavoh mikol ha'am, both in his, because fear would be on the arm, the nation, partially because of his physical stature, that he was head and shoulders above everybody. She'al deikach yeh chashuv b'ineham. And it was because of this that he would be important in their eyes. We have that similarly in American political history, right? How many, weren't all the presidents over 6 feet except for a handful or something?
Yeah, but David Ben-Gurion is very short, right, and important. Herzl is, David HaMelech is short and is important. Right.
I met Jimmy Carter, he was very short.
Yeah.
Who?
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he was shorter than me, so that must make him very short.
But they say that taller people are usually CEOs, yeah, and more successful. So there are always the exceptions to the rule. Did you see the movie Beneath the Helmet?
I didn't see it.
No.
It's so good. You should see it. So I was somewhere where one of the young men who's in the movie was, and he's like this skinny...
Right, they're not big guys.
Yeah.
They're all at my house.
Yeah. So... But anyway, Shaul does fit this generalization of leaders being tall. Okay, so I'm going on in the Alshich, the bottom of the page. Vatovadna atanot l'kish avi Shaul. So the donkeys, Kish, the father of Shaul's donkeys, were lost. Amar ra'u ki me'Hashem yatsa advar. And this is going to be the theme, sort of the rest of the shir. See that this whole thing came out of Hashem. She'im hayot Shaul chashuv b'chor v'tov v'she'ein ish tov mimenu me'odar k'medubar. If Shaul really was so important and he was so awesome and there was no person better than him and he was wonderful as it was said about him, im kol zeh shalchu aviv b'harim u'b'gayot levakesh et ha'atanot. Despite all this, his father sent him to the mountains and to the valleys to seek after the donkeys. Ach ein zeh ki im she'ikra mikro. All of this was just so all of these quote-unquote coincidences would occur. Ve'ilech el Shmuel lehamlicho. And he would eventually wind up at Shmuel, who would make him the king. Okay, one more Alshich on the next page. Kihine amru. So this is on Pasuk Yud Aleph, which, just to remind you, this is where they find the young maidens at the well. Okay, ki hine amru v'zal b'pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, because the rabbis say in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Akiva omer, kol mi shenichnas le'ir u'matza na'arot yotzot lefanav darko mitzlachat. So Rabbi Akiva says, anybody who enters a city and finds young women, his ways will be successful.
Really?
And then he proves it from the psukim.
All right.
Ba ora me'Eliezer. Come and see what from Eliezer. Ad shelo nichnas l'ir, matza na'arot yotzot lefanav. He comes into the city and he immediately finds young women going up before him. Breishit kafdal ad yud gimel. Ve'akardash baruch hu yitzliach darko. And Hashem made his way successful. Shene'amar ve'Hashem yitzliach darki. He himself says, Hashem made my way successful. Umi Moshe Rabbeinu ve'lakohen Midyan. In Moshe Rabbeinu we see when he meets the seven daughters of the priest of Midyan, who is Yitro, became his father-in-law, Vetovena, Vetadana, and they came and they filled up their buckets. V'hitzliach derko, and Hashem made his way successful. Ubara u'ara mishaul, and come now see from Shaul, she'ad shelo nichnas le'ir matza na'arot. He hadn't even entered the city and he found the young woman. V'zacha l'machut, and he merited machut. I may have mentioned this last week. I don't know the expression. Maybe you do, Shashi. Apparently there's an expression in modern Hebrew where they say they went to go seek out donkeys and became the king or something. Okay, there's some sort of expression somebody mentioned. V'chein be'Yaakov, we also have Yaakov. V'hinei Rachel b'ito ba'ayim atzon. Here Rachel is coming with the flock. Hinei ki p'giyatan b'Sha'ul hu siman mina shamayim. So therefore, when Shmuel writes for us that Sha'ul meets young women when he enters the city, this is a sign from the heavens al hatzlachat malchuto, on the success of his kingship. V'chein karov ha'davar ki gam sam Hashem b'fihen remez l'inyan hatzlachat malchuto. And it's very, the thing is very close because Hashem put in their mouths hints that he would succeed in the kingship based on what they said. Okay, so that is the Alshich that just adds to our understanding of who Shaul was. And then I want to discuss a little bit this issue of Shaul's major, major flaw. According to a lot of commentators, is not what Rav Amnon Bazak said about his inability to stick to a goal or subordinating to his servants, but rather his major, major flaw is that he's from Shevet Binyamin. Okay? So we see this in...
Why?
Because where is the kingship supposed to be from?
Yehuda.
From Yehuda, right? So we're going to explore this a little bit. I think this could be... a much longer shir about kingship. You can find it in other places. So I just wanted to look at a couple commentaries on it. So the pasuk in Bereshit that tells us is from Parshat Vayichi, when Yaakov is blessing his sons. And this is what he says to Yehuda. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda u'mechokek mi ben raglav ad ki avo shilo v'lo yikat amim. So, from the Chabad.org translation, the scepter will not depart from Yehuda, nor legislation from his descendants. Nations will submit to him until the final tranquility comes. It's very interesting that it says Shiloh, because we just, it's a Ketav in Kri, it's spelled Shiloh like our Shiloh, which was destroyed, right, prior to this whole situation of Shaul in the war. But Shiloh here is from, if you know anybody named Shalev, tranquility. Okay? So it's not Shaloh, it's Shiloh. Okay, so that's the pasuk in
Shalev. Shalev, I guess it will be switched to Yud and Lelamed, switch places.
Right.
It's interesting.
Okay, so Rashi there says, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. Mi David va'ilach. So Rashi doesn't have a problem with this. Rashi says, starting with David, it won't leave the hands of Shevet Yehuda. Elo Rashi galiot shebebavel sherodim et ha'am b'shevet shememonim al pi hamachut. So these, those who bear the scepter after the termination of the kingdom are the princes of Babylon who ruled over the people with the scepter and who were appointed by royal mandate. Okay, so, and then we do see this a little bit in Ezra and Nehemiah, where in Divrei Hayamim, that when they're finally able to come back to Eretz Yisrael, they make sure that it's somebody from the line of David, Zerubbabel, if any of you have sung all the stanzas of Ma'otzur. Zerubbabel, Ketzbabel, Zerubbabel. Okay, so so he is from, they make sure he's from the line of David. I always wondered in the book of Matthew, in the New Testament, the Christian Bible, it goes to such lengths to prove Jesus, Yashka's father, Joseph's lineage to David. It does this whole thing showing how he comes from David, but on the other hand, they're claiming an Immaculate Conception. So Joseph's lineage really is quite irrelevant to Jesus' birth. I've asked a few people about this. Nobody has a really satisfying answer. Okay, so so that's Rashi. He doesn't seem to have a problem. It's okay. You can have whatever king
wasn't,
you want.
Wasn't it also that she was raped on the way up to her house, like on the road? So Joseph is not at all... Even if
I don't know if that's in the Christian Bible, I don't know.
No, it's not in the Christian Bible, but it's in the Second Temple history.
Oh yeah, okay, but that yeah.
So. She was engaged to Joseph, and Joseph agreed to marry her, even though she got pregnant.
Oh, interesting.
Her fault.
And so she said, "Oh, it's not my fault."
It really is it.
But they had older children together, So I don't know about that.
Afterward.
I think
we after the first one.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Enough of that. Christianity. Okay. So the Ramban, I think I'll just read it in English. The case of Sheol should be understood as follows. So the Ramban, on the same pasuk, goes into a long thing, and he actually then, what I didn't include here, but just to make you known here, he also berates the Maccabees, who were Kohanim, I think, who then took over the kingship, and says that their kingship was doomed to failure because they weren't from Yehuda. So he brings that into this whole thing, to this discussion. But I didn't include that here. So the case of Sheol should be understood as follows. Because the whole matter of requesting a king at that time was considered contemptible by Hashem, he did not want to crown a king for them from the tribe of Yehuda, to whom the kingship belongs, and from whom it was never to depart. Therefore, he gave them a temporary kingship instead. The verse refers to this when it says, I gave you a king in my wrath and took away in my fury. From Hosea, meaning there was nothing meant to last about this kingship. He gave against his own desire, and therefore took him away in wrath, for he and his sons were killed, and the kingship ceased from him. So the Ramban takes a very different take from Rashi, and says it was on purpose that this king, in the way he was requested, should dafka not be from Yehuda, because the whole thing was inappropriate. Okay? And he goes on, and it was all of this because Shmuel was a judge and a prophet who fought their wars by the word of Hashem and saved them, and they should not have requested a king in his days. And he said to them, but Hashem, your God, is king. And Hashem said to him, it is not you that they have rejected, but it is me, we spent a lot of time on that, whom they have rejected from ruling over them. This is why he did not give Israel an everlasting kingship. In that which is written, you have acted foolishly. You did not keep the commandment of Hashem your God that he commanded you. For Hashem would have established your kingdom to Israel forever. That's underlined in the Hebrew as well, where it says El. And this is with, this is from Shmuel when he's going to talk to the people in Yud Gimel. No, this is Hosea. Sorry. That if he had not sinned, he could have secured the kingship over Israel for his offspring. It was not over all of them, and that is the reason it states to Israel. Perhaps he would have ruled over the tribes of his foremother, over Binyamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh, for Yehuda and Ephraim are considered as two nations in Israel. Or perhaps he would have ruled under a Judean king. Okay, so what the Ramban is saying is that the odds weren't entirely stacked against Sheol, that he should definitely fail. Even though that's what he seems to be implying in the beginning. He gave a king from Binyamin so that it would not be the permanent everlasting king over all of Israel. But Sheol did have a chance if he would have succeeded. So maybe in an ideal way, as opposed to what eventually happened, the lineage of Sheol would have continued to become a king over a sort of state of the sons of Rachel. So what eventually happened where there was a split was not ideal. But had Sheol succeeded, maybe there would have been a kosher sub-segment of the Jewish people, of the children of Rachel, that the line of Sheol would have continued to rule.
Why would it be good? I think it's awful.
It's sort of like the United States. Each Shevet had its own thing, and maybe there would have been a northern territory that would have had its own leader under the head king. You know?
No, I would hate to think of the tribe of Yosef and Benjamin not being part of Bnei Israel.
No, they would be part. They would be part.
But they would have their own kingship.
Right, but it would be similar to Lahavdil, like a New England chamber of a New England or Atlantic seaboard states having their own, but still very much being part of the United States of America and under the leadership of the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what's really interesting here and what the Ramban's saying is that even when the kingdom split in a non-kosher way, it was not the leaders, for the most part, were not from Binyamin. They were from Ephraim. And Ephraim sort of took over what would be the leadership position of the children of Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of totally lost out. And the children of Binyamin do not reemerge as leaders until the Megillah. With Mordechai and Esther. Or perhaps somebody from the children of Rachel, from the line of Shaul, would have been like a vice president under the president of Yehuda. So in that way, too, if Shaul had succeeded and kept all the laws, this could have happened, that there could have been this partnership between the children of Rachel and the children of Leah. And what happens is just, you know, what eventually happens with everything is horrible. We're going to get to this later, but just on this topic of Binyamin, maybe I should have talked, maybe we'll talk about it next week more intense, but there's a lot, if you think about it, we have the Pilegesh Begiva, right? Just not so distant past, which was Binyamin, where Binyamin was reduced down to this teeny tiny tribe because of their horrible actions. And if you look at the verses carefully, you see that Shaul is actually from this very same area where this took place. And that, yeah, we're going to talk about it soon when we appoint Shaul, and when he's publicly appointed, because in this chapter he's secretly appointed. And we're going to see how revolutionary this was to Bnei Israel to be able to unite behind this man from this very same subsection of Binyamin where this horrible event occurred that caused horrible civil war that reduced Binyamin to just 400 people. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's where Shaul is from. And the fact that you see his leadership and the potential of his leadership and the fact that he's able to unite all the people behind him to go to war. So we'll see that soon. Okay. So the last thing I want to look at now is, and we're going to spend the rest of the class on it, is going back to that Gemara that I skipped before. It's from the second page on the thing. So before the Al-Sheikh where we started today, I'm so sorry I didn't number these pages. Okay. So this page, sorry.
Do I have that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two. We're going to look at that also, so keep that handy.
Second page.
And where it says Talmud Bavli?
Yep.
Okay. Actually, before that, let's let's look at the continuation of the Psukim that we haven't read yet. Okay? So we ended when we were reading the Psukim, and it's all on that page. Sorry. So when we ended, they were the Na'arot, the young maidens, are giving him this whole long thing. They're talking to him a lot about going to see Shmuel. So Pasuk 14 is that they left, and as they leave, Shmuel is coming out to greet them. Okay? So the continuation of the Psukim in the middle of page 2. So Tetvav, Vehashem gala et ozen Shmuel yom echad lifnei bo Shaul limor. So Hashem had revealed to the ear of Shmuel one day before Shaul came, saying, so Shmuel had this nivuah, he knew to expect. What did he say? In Tet Zayin, Ke'et machar, at this time tomorrow, Eshlach alecha ish mi'eretz Binyamin, u'mishachto lenagid al ami Yisrael. I will send you a man from the land of Binyamin, and you shall anoint him to be a ruler over the people of Israel. And a nagid is, it's even more uplifted language than a king. David HaMelech is called a nagid as well. Okay, so this is very powerful language of what type of king he'll be. V'hoshia etami miyad plishtim, and he will save my nation from the hands of the plishtim. Ki ra'iti etami ki ba tzakato elai, because I saw my nation, because their cries came out to me. Now, if anybody's interested, there's a very interesting, on Rav Amnon Bazak, comparison between the previous parak, where Shmuel really yelled at them about the king, and this section here with how it seems to be totally two different totally perspectives on where the idea of the king is coming from. Because here, it seems to be that the idea of this king is coming from the people's cry about their fear of the plishtim, and that's why Hashem is appointing a king to them. And from what we saw in our whole discussion of this, that the people want a king to be like all the other nations, right? And then later on in chapter 12, Shmuel is going to hint that they're afraid of the king of Ammon, not the Plishtim, And in the meantime, Shmuel himself is the one who subdued the Plishtim in his life's work as the judge of the Jewish people. So there's a lot of interesting things going on here. You can read it on the VBM. He says that this chapter 9 is sort of a fresh perspective from a different point of view than what we've seen prior to this. Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. So anyway, Hashem said to Shmuel, the underlined and bolded in the English, underlined in the Hebrew, ke'et machar, at this time tomorrow. So now we're going to, so keep that in mind, and we're going to go on to this Gemara. And the Gemara is addressing the question of why the woman spoke so much to Shmuel, to Shaul, sorry, especially in light of the fact that what are they saying to Shaul? Hurry, hurry, hurry. You have to get there really quickly, and yet they keep talking and going on and on about what Shmuel is doing for the nation, this feast he's planning, all these things, and the Bama, the high places, etc., etc. They don't stop talking, but yet they want him to hurry. Okay? So the Gemara asks the question, V'kol kach lama, why did they talk so much? So there's a couple explanations first. Lefisha nashim dabranioten, because women talk a lot. Okay, so it's a little insulting. Vishmuel amar, so Shmuel, not our Shmuel, but the Shmuel in the Gemara, first century Amora, kedei lehistakel b'yav shel Shaul.
Yofio
shel Shaul. So because they wanted to keep looking at Shaul, they wanted to keep him in their presence as long as possible because he was such a beautiful, handsome man. Dichti mishich mo'amala gava mikol am, because as it's written, he was head and shoulders above the nation. Okay, so we have one, they talk a lot, women. Another, they wanted to be in his presence. And the third one is what's for our purposes the most interesting. Rabbi Yochanan Amar. Rabbi Yochanan is a student of Rav and Shmuel. He's second generation Amar. Lefi she'en machut nogat b'chaverta, Afilu Kemale Nema. So he's saying the reason why the women spoke to him so much and for so long has nothing to do with the character attributes of women per se, but it's all from Hashem, because two rulers cannot overlap even for a second. Okay? So we're seeing the changing of the guard from the period of judges, of Shmuel leading the people, to the period of Malchut, of kingship, of Shaul leading the people. And going back to the pasuk in that underlined word, ke'et machar, at this time tomorrow, so you have to envision that when Hashem is telling Shmuel, this man from Binyamin is coming at this time tomorrow, that you can even imagine a sundial, and Hashem is showing Shmuel a sign of the exact time when this were to take place. So it's saying that
if they're too early, then they have to hit.
Exactly. The women are a ruse to keep Shaul busy until that exact time when this is supposed to happen. So it sounds kind of crazy, and it's not convinced, because why would Hashem be limited in this way? Okay, I mean, I'm not completely convinced by it, and it doesn't really impress me, and I'm not too excited about this opinion until I started to think, and that is the last source on the supplementary page, and I'm going to hand out this, is where have we heard this line, ke'et machar, before? So, if you look at here, Hinani mamtir ke'et machar barad kaved ma'od asher lo haya kamoha v'mitzrayim limin hayom hivasta ve'adata. So behold, I am going to rain down on you at this time tomorrow heavy hail, so heavy that you have never seen like it in Egypt from the day that it has been established until now. Okay? So this is the story of the plague. And this is the story of Moshe and his leadership of the Jewish people, his emerging leadership of the Jewish people, in bringing them out of Egypt. Okay? So the Ke'et Machar is not just important in this is when Shaul, the exact time that Shaul is taking over for the Jewish people, but it's also an intertextual dialogue for us to see that Shaul's emergence as a leader of the Jewish people is going to be very similar to Moshe Rabbeinu's emergence as a leader of the Jewish people. And at this point of time, we're to see Shaul as a Moshe Rabbeinu. But we're already in Eretz Yisrael, so it's a Moshe Rabbeinu in the Promised Land, right? And that's his potential of what he could have been. Unfortunately, he didn't live up to that potential, right? We'll have to explore that in the coming prakim. But what you have in front of you on the second sheet is from Rabbi Shulman, where he goes into great detail, giving you all these intertextual dialogues, both thematically and pasuk-wise, of comparisons between our text and the text having to do with Moshe Rabbeinu. He doesn't include this Ke'et Chaya pasuk, but that was really the jumping point for me, was that. So the first one, he has that we are introduced to Shaul in his worrying about the donkeys. What does this remind you about with Moshe Rabbeinu? There's a midrash. It's not in
the... Most of worrying about the goat.
Right, worrying about the sheep. Yeah, he becomes the shepherd of his father-in-law. Shaul is not the shepherd, but taking care of the donkeys of his father. And Hashem knew that Moshe was the appropriate leader because of how he treated the sheep. And we see Shaul and how he's worried about these donkeys. Okay, so his mission and the language of his appointment. So you can see in the way Rabbi Shulman bolded different things that these are similar. So here, v'eshlach alecha ish mi'eretz binyamin. So the end in Shmot Gimel, v'eshlachacha el paro. So both are sent on a mission, shlichut. And in our parak, ki ra'iti atami ki ba tzakatoilai. So I've seen my nation, that their cry calls out to me, what we just read. And again, in Shmot Perek Gimel, with Moshe speaking to Hashem at the burning bush, ra'o ra'iti et oni ami, I saw the affliction of my people, tzakatam shamati, I heard their cries. Tzakat b'nei Yisrael ba'a elai. Again, very similar, the exact same language. The cries of b'nei Yisrael cries out to me. Okay, so, and then so the next one is their victory, which we haven't gotten to yet in Shmuel Aleph, and the next one is how they accept their appointment out of humility. They don't want it. We're going to hear Shaul say when we continue on in this parak, Anochi mikatane shivtei Yisrael, but I'm from the smallest of the tribes. I don't deserve to be king, basically. We're also going to see later on, this in Parak Yud of Shmuel Aleph, that he receives three signs from that miraculous signs, and we also know Moshe gets three signs. And the failure of the first appointment, Moshe Rabbeinu fails when he first goes to Paro. When Shaul is made king, there are many murmurings against him that we're going to see. Their humility, obviously, that's a big similarity between Moshe and Shaul. And the kingship is torn from him. Moshe Rabbeinu, his children don't get to inherit in the same way that Shaul's children don't get to inherit. Okay, so we have in this first chapter our introduction to Shaul. We have a clear showing of Shaul's appropriateness to take over, and it's our comparison with the psukim from Devarim. And we have a lot of hints that he has the potential to be the next Moshe Rabbeinu for the Jewish people in this intertextual dialogue going on between Shaul and Moshe Rabbeinu. And we'll continue next week.
Please visit the Beit Midrash for the National Honor Society.